Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 248. Sound Sleep, Sound Mind with Dr. Barry Krako. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Most insomniacs actually do get sleepy, but they get sleepy at the wrong time of day, often in the early evening or in the afternoon, and they will even tell you sometimes they doze off. But in the evening time, they have done certain things, or certain things have taken hold in terms of their own habits, where they do not necessarily or naturally bring the wave of sleepiness in close to bedtime. And that's one of the things, you know, that we teach them. You know, how can you bring the wave around the evening bedtime hours so that you can, you know, tap into it and go to sleep? And if you wake up at night, tap into it again and go back to sleep.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Barry Krako, discussing the problem of insomnia and keys to sleeping through the night. Barry Krako, MD, is a board-certified internist and sleep disorders specialist who has spent over 30 years in medicine in the fields of internal emergency, addiction, and sleep medicine. He's conducted more than two decades of research in the treatment of chronic nightmares and disturbing dreams at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine and the Sleep and Human Health Institute. Dr. Krako graduated magna cum laude from the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He was residency trained and board certified in internal medicine and also has 10 years of clinical work in emergency medicine. He's a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and the Sleep Research Society, and is the former medical director of University Hospital Sleep Disorders Center. Dr. Krako has published two books, Insomnia Cures and his most recent, Sound Sleep, Sound Mind, which is the first book of its kind to focus on mental, emotional, and physical causes of sleep disturbances. Dr. Krako and his wife Jessica Kaur Krako have also published Turning Nightmares into Dreams, an innovative self-help audio series and workbook to eliminate bad dreams. Dr. Krako is the medical director of Maimonides Sleep Arts and Sciences in Albuquerque, New Mexico, as well as the principal investigator of the Sleep and Human Health Institute, a nonprofit research facility. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Barry Krako, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks, David.
Yeah, you and I have been, we're both been members and presenters at the International Association for the Study of Dreams conferences, and I believe we met at one of those sessions a few years back.
Right, right.
Yeah, now you trained as an internist and later worked as an emergency room physician. So how did you come to be interested in sleep?
Well, I've had my own sleep problems for years, and I don't know that that actually got me into the field. I started doing some work on nightmares back in 1988 with Joseph Neidhart and Robert Kellner at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. But as I got more into the field of nightmare treatment and nightmare research, I noticed that a lot of the things I was reading about were relevant to my own sleep problems. So I found that it was very useful to start applying techniques to treat my own insomnia, my own sleep breathing conditions. I even have a mild case of restless leg syndrome. So once those connections started to get made, it turned out to be a very useful field to go into.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You know, people often speculate that psychotherapists go into the work of psychotherapy because really they need to work on themselves. This sounds like an interesting variant on that theme.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, you have your own sleep clinic now there in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called the Maimonides Center, and you also head up your own sleep research institute. Is that right?
Right. The research institute is the Sleep and Human Health Institute. That started in 2000, and then to actually be able to put food on my table, I opened up a sleep center in 2002, which is the Maimonides Sleep Arts and Sciences.
Yes, well, I love the fact that you're involved both in research and in practical application, and that the two are nurturing one another. Now, I've been reading your 2007 book, Sound Sleep, Sound Mind, Seven Keys to Sleeping Through the Night, The Drug-Free Mind-Body Approach to Getting the Sleep You Need. How big a problem is insomnia?
It's huge. It's probably the single biggest sleep disorder out there, in the sense that even though people don't use that word insomnia, what they describe fits the category of insomnia. That is, a large proportion of the population will say either they have difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep, early morning awakenings, or they will say that the quality of their sleep is non-restorative. All four of those categories meet nosological criteria, you know, the actual definition, diagnostic criteria for insomnia. And it's amazing how many people, maybe more than half the population, can have that problem at any one time. Obviously, there's people who have it much more severely, and that's thought to be somewhere in the 11 to 17% range of adults who have chronic and, you know, significant clinically, you know, meaningful insomnia.
Well, I know from personal experience, as well as that of my wife and other close friends, that it can be very, very frustrating. For me, it's not chronic, but every now and then I'll have a run of insomnia. Now, am I right that you suggest that rather than laying in bed and struggling to get to sleep, you suggest getting up and going to another room and occupying yourself until you get sleepy?
Right. Dick Bootson, pioneered this concept called stimulus control. And I think that the data was published back in the 1970s showing that when a person lies in bed not sleeping, they are in fact teaching themselves not to sleep. And the psychophysiological conditioning that ensues is one of the leading causes of insomnia. So the person who can break that cycle, and it's not always easy to get up out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning and go do something else. But when a person does that and does it the right way, which means not with lots of stress in their mind and not lots of worry about losing more sleep, then there's a good chance they'll break that cycle. They'll get sleepy again. They'll go back to bed and they'll go to sleep.
It seems to me that this whole field of sleep and insomnia, in terms of advice, you know, I've read other books, and it seems maybe it's a little bit like the field of nutrition, you know, where you get this conflicting advice about, you know, what you should be eating. Don't other experts advocate just lying there, saying that the rest will do you good, whether you actually sleep or not?
Well, I'm sure there are people that do, and the question would be, And I'm not trying to make fun of anybody, but it's a question of what kind of expert are they? In other words, are they actually somebody who studied the science of sleep and understands how insomnia does produce a very vexing mental state that leads to a tremendous amount of agitation, racing thoughts, ruminations? And if so, what is the model that allows them to say, we'll just stay in bed and get some rest and so forth? In my clinical experience, there are a few cases where you may have somebody just lay in bed because that person may have a pain syndrome or something that makes it very, very difficult for them to get out of bed. But long-term, as much as I do advocate the use of this technique, stimulus control, the techniques I have in my book involving working with thoughts, feelings, and images can eventually lead most insomnia patients to not have to get up out of bed. I'm simply describing that method because you mentioned it, and it's a very powerful method. It can be very useful in the short term for many, many patients because it relieves the pressure. But long term, I would prefer to teach people how if they woke up in the middle of the night, they could actually roll over and go back to sleep within just a couple of minutes.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get into that, and that's a useful clarification. I'm wondering if there might be two different issues. The first one being difficulty falling asleep when you first go to bed, and the second one being waking up during the night and having difficulty getting back to sleep. I think they're both called insomnia, but I'm wondering, do these have different underlying dynamics, or are they essentially the same issue?
But that is one of the more interesting areas of the research on insomnia, because in one sense they're the same in that the person who does wake up in the middle of the night, their real complaint isn't necessarily that they woke up. Their real complaint is usually that they have trouble going back to sleep, which means it's just like the beginning of the night. They have trouble going to sleep. So there is that particular part of it. Now, as we've spoken about previously, we have been doing research on this exact problem called why do insomniacs wake up at night? And we're working on a study right now where we're looking at classic insomniacs who have no other symptoms, just the insomnia that's, you know, been bothering them, no other explanation that is for it. And what we found is that most of them have a breathing event prior to their waking up from the, in the middle of the night. In that particular case, though, they still have the same problem. So regardless of the cause of why somebody wakes up, the insomnia patient tends to have this trouble of going back to sleep. And again, that mirrors what may be the same problem they have in the beginning of the night. So there are some differences, but that one particular theme is there, and that does tie it together and sometimes help insomniacs in their treatment because they begin to realize my difficulty is that I can't get to sleep. And as I describe in my book, one of the biggest reasons for that is that these individuals have difficulty recruiting what I call the wave of sleepiness that a person should be able to recruit when they're either going to sleep or if it's the middle of the night and they're going back to sleep.
I love that you talk about this wave because my wife and I have had a long-standing marital joking, quote, argument because I talk about, for years I've said, no, I've got to go to bed now. I don't want to miss my wave. I got to catch my wave, you know, almost like it's surfing.
You're from California.
Yeah. But I had this sort of intuitive sense that there is this wave and I have to catch it. And that if I miss that wave by going to bed later than my normal time, I'm going to miss that wave.
Yeah. There's some element of truth in that what you'll see is, there are certain patients who they go a little bit beyond their, quote, normal bedtime, and they suddenly wake up a little bit, get a little bit more alert, and the next thing you know, they're into something else. So I think there is some truth in that, although, again, what I teach is that once you really learn what underlies the things that would block that wave, then you can actually realize that you can make the wave come on at the right time, is what I'll call it, in the evening, at bedtime, and so forth. And if you happen to miss it a particular night, then it doesn't take a lot of steps to bring it back as long as you understand, you know, what that process is that was blocking the wave.
Well, I guess I had the impression that there was some kind of 90-minute biorhythm cycle going on in the background.
Yeah, I think there are people who try to exclaim those kinds of research ideas in a way to say that will absolutely, unequivocally, you know, tap into when you should go to sleep and so forth. I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, it may be true for somebody who's really having difficulty with sleep schedules and needs to, you know, normalize or regularize their sleep schedule, but really, the wave is growing all day long because as you continue to be awake, what's called your homeostatic sleep pressure or sleep drive is building. So it's there, and that's one of the things that's so fascinating about insomnia patients. Many insomnia patients, and this is usually not perceived in the conventional wisdom of science, which is unfortunate, and I have many debates with my colleagues about this, but most insomniacs actually do get sleepy, but they get sleepy at the wrong time of day, often in the early evening or in the afternoon, and they will even tell you sometimes they doze off. But in the evening time, they have done certain things or certain things have taken hold in terms of their own habits where they do not necessarily or naturally bring the wave of sleepiness in close to bedtime. And that's one of the things, you know, that we teach them. You know, how can you bring the wave around the evening bedtime hours so that you can, you know, tap into it and go to sleep? And if you wake up at night, tap into it again and go back to sleep.
Well, how do you bring the wave in?
Well, the way things start here is that we think about what the classic presentation is for an insomnia patient when they come to Maimonides. And I'll tell you that the individual who sees us is usually middle-aged, maybe a little bit older, could be a man or a woman. And they've had the insomnia for several years. It's never like they just walked in the door because they've got 3 months of insomnia. In fact, it's rare to meet somebody who's had insomnia for less than a year. Usually these people have struggled with the problem for 2 to 20 years. And what we find in the very first session, and what we talk about in the very first session, and what I emphasize over and over in the Sound Sleep book, is that these individuals are completely out of balance with what I call the TFI system, which stands for thoughts, feelings, and images. And of course, feelings encompasses the feelings of sleepiness, the feelings of fatigue, but also lots of other feelings, you know, lots of emotions that people have. And what I've learned is that most of these people are living, so to speak, in their minds. Most of their attention is spent towards the cognition of verbal thought, you know, racing thoughts, ruminations, driving themselves very, you know, diligently during the day on their work, but also, you know, ruminating on their problems. And what I'm saying here very, very literally is they spend much of their life in their mind, and they do not have a strong appreciation of the way their body works in terms of feelings and emotions. And the reason this is so critical is that the wave of sleepiness is tied into feelings that also are, you know, coming through the body, not just something experienced through the mind.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Now, in the book, you say all sleep is not the same, that there's quality sleep, and you seem to come down pretty strongly on the point that most people are not getting high-quality sleep. How do you judge sleep quality?
Well, it's an interesting question in its own right because what it actually triggers is the concept of how people even think about their sleep. In other words, getting the quality sleep is a fairly complex process where you have to look at lots of mental and physical factors. But when I was referring earlier to the TFI system and how people are thinking about things too much in their life as opposed to doing more feelings, what happens is they adopt a thought about sleep which is strictly geared towards how much sleep they are getting. And this is one of the first paradigms that we have to sort of break through if we're going to teach them how to get to the wave of sleepiness. We're going to have to get them to be able to see that the thought about counting up hours of sleep is actually going to cause them a problem, because what they should be feeling is an understanding about what does it mean to have quality sleep. Quality sleep would mean that you wake up in the morning and you feel great. You have energy throughout the day. You get back into bed at the end of a long, good, strong, active, fulfilling, satisfying day. And then you get back into bed, and what do? Well, you recruit the wave of sleepiness, and you fall asleep, and you sleep all through the night, and you feel great the next morning. So that process is something that people who are going through this, the insomniacs, really have very little appreciation for it. They all think about it as, well, it's insomnia, so I must not be getting the right number of hours of sleep. And this is why we focus so much on the TFI system, because only by working on the TFI system, thoughts, feelings, and images, can we teach them the balance points that allow them to understand that they can do this. They can actually change their perspective and get away from the concept of sleep quantity and then be thinking about sleep quality. And it's once you do that, then you do have a chance to understand that you have control over the wave of sleepiness.
Okay. Now, one of the things that fascinated me in the book is your assertion that most people are not getting good quality sleep because of micro awakenings during the night. And I think you suggested that some people actually might have like 300 micro awakenings in a single night. Yeah, tell us.
Yeah, most people with insomnia, the research shows that they're hyper aroused. But the theory about this is very confusing, because the only working theory of hyperarousal right now is that either the patient is born with it, or they're just psychologically predisposed to it because, again, maybe they're a worrier or they're tense. And this, again, goes back to the TFI system in terms of the feeling component. And what happens is these people are not able to organize themselves in a way on a daily basis to cope where they can actually reduce the arousal. As I mentioned in other venues, you know, this arousal also may be a function of these breathing disorders, but the truth is many people with insomnia, for whatever reasons, have multiple awakenings and arousals during the night. Well, in my book, Sound Sleep, what I talk about is you can actually trigger part of that by the way you're working with your feelings and with your emotions during the day. If you're somebody that's not coping well, and by that I mean not engage in active emotional processing throughout the day, you're going to build up more psychic tension, more physiological tension. And that process is the one that is absolutely classic, going back to this concept of the classic presentation of the insomnia patients we see. Not only are these individuals thinking too much, but the way they're working with their emotions during the day, which is almost non-existent in many cases, is actually now leading to a hyperarousal state, which then, of course, is going to carry over into their sleep.
So you're not only going to work with them around issues in the sleep lab, but you're also teaching them what strategies for handling their emotions during the day. What would be your approach to that? Would it be cognitive behavioral or psychoanalytic, or?
Well, we take a cue from Leslie Greenberg's work. He uses the term emotion-focused therapy, and we use the term sleep-related emotion-focused therapy. And I was very, very honored that, you know, Dr. Greenberg put a blurb on our book, Sound Sleep, you know, regarding our work on sleep-related emotional processing. And where we start with this is a typical example that, you know, comes up in the clinical encounter with the patient, usually the very first encounter. And I will ask the patient, so what exactly is going on with you that's causing you not to sleep? And most of the time, people will say things like, I think too much, got a lot of racing thoughts. They'll say, I'm anxious, I'm stressed, I'm anxious, depressed, I worry, you know, a bunch of sort of buzzwords in my mind that aren't always, they're more on the surface than what's really going on. So I'll say to them, well, can you give me an example of what you mean by that? In other words, when you say you're stressed out, is there some example maybe that happened yesterday or last week? And literally in 5 seconds, the patient will say, well, sure, yeah, like at work, I had such and such an encounter, you know, with my boss. And they'll start talking about this encounter. And what's so fascinating to listen to these people is that as they talk about this encounter, they will never once mention any emotion or feeling that occurred in the encounter. So basically, they're describing some kind of conflict, say, with their boss. And I'll say to them, well, so that's what stressed you out. And they go, yeah, yeah, I have that a lot with my boss. I get stressed out. And I go to them, well, did you feel anything else besides stress? And they look at me like I'm from outer space, you know, like, what do you mean? Well, did you feel something else there? Was there some other feelings, emotions, whatever? And, you know, the person might take a step back and go, well, as a matter of fact, yeah, I was somewhat frustrated. I said, well, good. Now, let me ask you this question, because this is the $64,000 question. And I can say that because, you know, we're the same generation, right, David?
Right.
Okay. So here's the $64,000 question I will ask virtually every insomnia patient, and I will almost always get the, quote, wrong answer. And I will say to them, where do you feel that frustration? And, of course, this is a trick question, because almost every insomniac will look at me and they'll go, well, I feel it at work sometimes, and I'll feel it sometimes at home. I said, no. What I want to know is, where do you feel your frustration? And they still look at me, and I finally have to say, where in your body do you feel this frustration? And the answer in 90% of the cases is, well, I don't know what you're talking about. And they point to their head, and they go, that's where I know it. I know it in my head. I think about it. I don't actually feel it, I guess. And this is the hallmark sign that these individuals are not really experiencing their emotions the way emotions are meant to be experienced, which is, of course, you're supposed to feel them in your body. And this is the first breakthrough that these patients have, where they begin to realize that when I say thoughts, feelings, images, I really mean it. And the patients actually resonate with this very, very quickly, because they go, oh, you mean this is what's the cause of my racing thoughts? I say, absolutely. Your racing thoughts are your manifestation of how you learn to work with human emotion, and it's very, very ineffective. It's very inefficient. We're going to have to teach you ways to start getting back in touch with what you can feel in your body. Now, the good news is there are some patients, when you have this discussion, they will say, oh, I know what you mean, like that time that I got angry 6 months ago, and I actually felt it in my chest, and I got, you know, really tight and red and angry. So, yeah, that's called, you know, feeling your emotions as opposed to thinking about them. And so when that happens, that particular patient, I can say, look, you've already done this. You're moving in the right direction. The goal, of course, of this is not emotional venting or emotional expression in excess. It's rather understanding what the nature of human emotion is about, how it's supposed to serve you and protect you, and how it's supposed to help you by providing you with a form, really, of emotional intelligence that allows you to move through your day in a much more relaxed fashion. Most insomniacs do not understand this, and this is what is one of the main triggers to how they end up with insomnia.
So in part, what you're doing is kind of an educational process and teaching them to be sensitive to things that are currently out of their awareness and that they're handling in kind of an automatic way. And that brings me back to...
Right. Let me just mention, that's exactly right, because their automatic way means ignore the feeling, let me think about the feeling. And one of the crux discussion points for these patients in their education is, do you actually understand the difference of what it means to think about a feeling versus actually feel a feeling?
Yes.
And most of them will say, no, I don't think I understand that.
Yes, yes. Now, speaking of things that are automatic, I want to go back to the breathing. You talk about, because these micro awakenings are often caused, as you mentioned earlier, by breathing problems.
Right.
And you use the term SDB, which I guess stands for sleep disordered breathing. And the challenge there is that we're not aware of these breathing problems that are disturbing our sleep.
Right. And not only that, the breathing problem is by causing so much fragmentation of the sleep. Because remember, there's three basic types of breathing events. Apneas means that you stop breathing. Hypopnea stands for about a 50% reduction in breathing. And something we call upper airway resistance is about a 25% reduction in breathing. Well, it's kind of like analogous to the concept of pregnancy. You know, can you be a little bit pregnant? Can you have a little bit of breathing difficulty? You see, each of these breathing events are like mini suffocations. And it doesn't matter whether it's a 25%, a 50%, or 100%. All three types of breathing events do trigger arousal activity in the mind. And this is what will cause hundreds of arousals during the night. Obviously, it's a form of sleep fragmentation leading to sleep deprivation, because with so much sleep fragmentation, you're eventually losing some of your sleep. And when that happens, you get to be tired and cranky and irritable and anxious and depressed the next day. So now you've got a physiological explanation for why individuals would also have difficulty coping with their emotions or even being aware of their emotions. They're just plain too tired to do it.
So there's kind of a vicious cycle going on there. You know, I think many of us have heard of sleep apnea, but it sounds like there are breathing events that maybe would come, you know, that wouldn't reach that criterion that we think of as apnea, where a person, you know, just stops breathing for a while, that there are much less dramatic events, but nevertheless, they're having an impact on the quality of our sleep.
Absolutely, and that's very germane to insomnia patients, because they often will produce not the classic apnea problem in terms of diagnosis, but these other events that I mentioned, hypopneas and upper airway resistance. And yet these 25% to 50% reductions, are more than enough to produce these arousals and these awakenings. And in fact, as I mentioned in this study that we're looking at recently, these awakenings are often caused by people having the breathing event. But I want to go back, if we might, to the concept of how all of this plays out in terms of this set of breathing problems, these stressors from not dealing with your emotions, how it all conspires to, again, get the individual caught up in not looking at the quality of their sleep, getting totally mesmerized by the idea that the number of hours they're supposed to sleep is where the secret, you know, to their solution is here, and then how, when that keeps playing out, it prevents individuals from recognizing how much power they have within themselves to take control of their sleep problems simply by balancing the thoughts, feelings, imagery system. When you mentioned earlier about the concept of, do you get up out of bed or do you stay in bed, what we're learning is that when we can treat somebody's imbalanced thought, feeling, imagery system, teaching them how to reduce the racing thoughts by spending more time working with their emotions and even throwing in some imagery work, these things then will allow a patient to roll over and get back to sleep in a very reasonable fashion and not have to take a pill. And that's why this is so powerful, because it's something within the individual that they can do. The secret to it, though, as far as I can tell from my clinical work, has been that most of these patients will not address their lack of coping skill in terms of how they actually process emotion. They really just don't get it. Some of them it takes a couple weeks, some a couple months, some a couple years. But the exciting thing about it for us in treatment is that they don't have to become super emotional processing people. It's not like it's a psychotherapy and it takes 2 years to do it. It turns out that if a person just begins to recognize this process, that their racing thoughts really are a form of trying to block themselves from feeling, just that single idea can actually begin to free up the insomniac, where literally in the middle of the night they have racing thoughts. We teach them what's the very first thought you want to have once you recognize you have racing thoughts. And the answer is, I must be hiding from some feeling. Now, if the insomniac can do that, they will actually start to move down the direction saying, well, what's the feeling I'm hiding from? And once they start to do that, there's a chance they're going to feel some of that feeling. And that is enough sometimes to break the cycle of insomnia, which is amazing how little they have to do to get there.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, I'm still hung up on the breathing issue. And in relation to that, what's the relationship between snoring and sleep quality? That part was a little confusing for me in the book.
Snoring is something that is confusing, and it's something we try to get our patients away from paying much attention to, because snoring produces an outward appearance of a problem that does not reflect back on what's going on internally in the body. And what I mean by that is, you can snore and not have a sleep breathing problem. But more importantly, you don't have to snore to have a sleep breathing problem. So in research we've done with insomniacs, we have seen situations where 75% of the patients walking into clinic will say, I don't snore. Then we put them in the sleep lab, and 75% of them snore. So it's very, very confusing. But again, I want to point out that unfortunately, the mainstream media plays on this particular problem of snoring in a way that comes to the point of what I call media malpractice, because they will actually say in their coverage, and I see this all the time in news clips, in magazine articles, in newspaper pieces, where it says the phrase, if you don't snore, then forget about having a sleep breathing problem. And that's absolute nonsense. That was disproven more than 20 years ago. There are many, many people who don't snore who have very serious sleep breathing problems that need to be treated. And among them, as you might guess from our discussion today, insomnia patients are one of the biggest categories of people who don't snore and yet still have these sleep breathing problems.
Yeah, interesting. And in your book, you talk about the airway passage, the flow of air, and even advocate that people experiment with these nasal strips. And as a matter of fact, I started doing that again just as a result of reading the book. I've done it in the past when my nose was all plugged up. Mm-hmm. But I think actually in my own case, I don't think I have a super wide air passage, and I think that could be helpful. So I'm going to see how that goes.
We're going to have to fly you out here and get a sleep study in Albuquerque.
Yeah, well, believe me, I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about it.
Well, this is the part that was so important for me in terms of writing the Sound Sleep book, because in putting forward my paradigm, what I call sleep dynamic therapy, it was very clear to me that if you really want to help an insomniac, you've got to look at the mental, physical components, the psychological and physiological. And they're both incredibly powerful. I'm so pleased that, you know, you're seeing all the information we have there about the breathing disorders, because we know that most insomnia patients from our clinical work, and we're talking about thousands of people that we have seen, have these sleep breathing problems. Sometimes they're mild, sometimes, you know, they're moderate, sometimes they're severe. But it's very difficult to get a great treatment for the insomnia patient unless you can help them to fix their breathing problem by using CPAP or dental devices or nasal strips or allergy treatments, you know, whatever it takes. But on the other side of the coin is the psychological treatment. Mm-hmm. And I'll say the same thing. Unless I can get them to have a little bit of a breakthrough about their emotional processing problems, I will have, again, a problem getting them to where I want in terms of optimizing their care. And in the Sound Sleep book, we deal with that. We deal with all of this stuff. And in our clinic, we don't say to the patients what is some of the traditional models, which we think are mistaken, honestly. Most people look at insomnia patients and say, well, give them this cognitive behavioral therapy for several months, and if it doesn't work, get a sleep test. Or somebody else might say, well, they're snoring, so get the sleep study first, and if they still have insomnia, we'll give them some CBT, you know, 6 months later. We don't do that at all. Everything is simultaneous therapy at our center. We want the patient to get the sleep breathing evaluation right away, but we also want them to get a complete understanding and education about the TFI system, the thoughts, feelings, and images, so they can see what part of that might be causing the psychological part of their insomnia. So we go down the psychological and the physiological paths together, and I can't tell you how many people love that. They just love it. And the reason they love it is because most insomniacs think there is something physically wrong with them. It's amazing how much smarter the patients are than the clinicians, because in terms of conventional wisdom, it's actually taught to ignore the patient when they make that comment. You're actually told that when the insomnia patient says there's something physically wrong, don't believe them, because it's probably likely to be psychological or psychophysiological. The truth is the insomnia patient has been right all along. There tends to be a lot more of these breathing disturbances in insomnia patients than anybody would have previously imagined. And, you know, one of the reasons I'm so passionate about it is that I discovered it in myself about 13 years ago, and I had the good fortune of a colleague of mine, Thomas Mead, who is a dentist, and he made one of these dental devices for me. And I'd been having insomnia for about 2 years, and I was waking up every night, and he said, Barry, just try one of these dental devices and see what happens. And I began using a dental device, and my insomnia all but disappeared.
What sort of device is this?
These are things that go into your mouth. It's a double dental impression, and it holds the jaw in a slightly thrusted position where the lower jaw extends out a little bit more than average, you know, more than usual, I mean. And by doing so, the back of the throat becomes a little bit expanded, and you breathe better.
Now, are these generally available if somebody wanted to try it? Is this something somebody could order, or what would they ask their dentist for?
Well, you'd have to go to the dentist and ask for oral appliance therapy, and oftentimes you would meet a dentist who doesn't know how to make one or hasn't had experience in making one. And you would have to find a dentist who does have the experience, because usually they're shipped out to a lab and manufactured. They're fairly expensive. Oftentimes insurance coverage is available for some of them. There used to be models sold over the counter that are called boil and bite devices. I don't know if they're even available anymore because they were very problematic. And these are the kinds of things when you're working with teeth, you know, you want to get an expert, working on it so that there's not something they're going to mess up your bite, you know, or cause other dental problems.
You know, I'm glad that you raised the issue of what, you know, other clinics do. I mean, this is not the only sleep center in the country, right? There are other sleep clinics scattered around. And I've wondered, well, how controversial is your approach? Because I haven't heard, previously of this, of your TFT kind of approach where you combine emotions and so on, and also the emphasis on micro awakening. So I'm just wondering if other sleep clinics use the same paradigm or if your paradigm is actually pretty unique.
I think that the sleep dynamic therapy approach is unique in that it says there's much more going on in these patients than we've previously admitted or understood or, you know, made attempts to observe. And I do see a lot of second opinion cases. I get patients from all over the country coming to our center, and they're basically saying, well, I went to my center and they gave me CPAP and it didn't work, and I want to know if you have something else to try, or whether there's something about the way my insomnia was treated. They just said, take these pills. So on the one hand, there's lots of people out there that are practicing what's called behavioral sleep medicine. They're providing lots of cognitive behavioral therapy for patients. I do believe that what we offer in the way of sleep-related emotional processing skills and the imagery work that we do are a more complete approach to the psychological side of things. And I believe that by working on these physiological dimensions, such as the sleep-breathing problems, again, adds more, you know, it makes the picture more full in terms of what's going on. And my sense is that other sleep centers, some of them are starting to move in this direction, but in general, I don't know how easily they're geared to do that. My particular background is what's probably made me have the opportunity to do this, because I was trained as an internist, yet for the last 20 years, because of my work with Dr. Neidhart and Dr. Kellner, as well as with Michael Hollifield, who was also at the University of New Mexico at the time, because of those interactions, I was working with mental health patients for the last 20 years who all have sleep disorders. That's my specialty. So I think what happened was, because as an internist, I became very comfortable with the physiological side of things, I also had this incredible exposure and mentoring from all of these psychiatrists and a few psychologists, from the field of sleep, helping me to learn more and more about the psychological side. And putting that all together, I began to see that most insomniacs did not benefit, in my opinion, from only getting a restricted view of their insomnia and only getting treatment in one area. And that's why I'm so strongly, pushing for the idea that you give the insomnia patient the psychological and the physiological treatments together in whatever dosing, that they can.
Well, are you doing any training? Are you going to create some other Barry Krakows out there?
I wouldn't want to wish that on the world. But with respect to training, it's interesting you mentioned that. We have our first workshop that's coming up on November the 10th, where we've got a bunch of things going on. It's actually November the 9th, 10th, and 11th. And what we're doing is we're training on our idea about the PTSD sleep clinic. We're giving training about the imagery rehearsal therapy for insomnia. But we've also got another day on November 11th where we're spending all day talking about the stuff that we're talking about here, which is a half a day on sleep-related emotional processing techniques, and then a half a day on very complex sleep cases and what you can do to give that patient both the psychological and the physiological treatments that they need. Eventually, what I think we're going to be doing is both doing workshops, on-site at our sleep facility in Albuquerque, but also going to other centers around the country. And in fact, there's two workshops that are in development right now for Israel and Germany for next summer. So I think that there is a chance for us to reach out and bring this style to other sleep centers. But it may be even more important in some ways for other therapists. Because I think therapists have a tremendous opportunity to engage the sleep field by being more aware about sleep problems, and also doing some of these other techniques that are sleep related. When I say the imagery work or the sleep related emotion focused therapy.
Okay, well, I'll be sure to put a link to your website in our show notes, and I'll also mention the website address in my post-interview comments, and I'm sure that people will be able to find information on your website about these workshops. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have lots of stuff on our website, sleeptreatment.com. That's sleeptreatment.com. That has a lot of information about the upcoming workshops and, of course, a lot more information about, you know, all the stuff we do with sleep dynamic therapy, the imagery work, sleep-related emotional processing, other websites that we have, because we try to branch out in a lot of areas. We have nightmaretreatment.com. We have PTSDsleepclinic.com. We have sleepdynamictherapy.com. And all of these serve specific purposes for the particular type of patient, and their interest. And the sleepdynamictherapy.com is my blog.
Okay, well, as we begin to close down here, you did mention pills at one point, and so I just want to touch on that before we close off. What's your take on Ambien and Lunesta and so on? I know I've certainly found them to be helpful at times, especially for international travel.
Right, right. My feeling about the medications are that they are wonderful drugs for certain people at certain times. But what I think about them goes far beyond that in terms of how I perceive them in clinical practice. We just published two papers, one in the Primary Care Companion to the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, and the other one is just coming out next month in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease. And both papers looked at samples of people who walked in the door who were regularly using Ambien or Lunesta or some other drug such as Trazodone. And on average, these people were using these drugs for 4 years. Well, No surprise from what we've been talking about, what we found were two really obvious things. Number one, 70 to 90% of these people in these two different samples, and both samples, by the way, were reasonably sized. One was about 130, the other is about 250. 70 to 90% of these people had sleep breathing problems. And that is one of the reasons they kept waking up at night and why the medicine actually wasn't working that well.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing was these patients were terrible at emotional processing. They still had racing thoughts. They still were living in their minds. The drug was simply masking all of this, and it worked temporarily. But nobody, for whatever reasons, was addressing that this is what led the patient to getting on the pill. It wasn't just a question that they needed some simple cognitive behavioral therapy. It was these patients were very, very poor at working with their emotions. Some of them had even been to therapists, and the therapist kind of threw up their hands and said, look, you're just going to have to take a pill to help you sleep. But the truth of the matter is, in my opinion, is that these patients can work with therapists and sleep doctors who are willing to, consider sleep-related emotional processing and the thoughts, feelings, imagery paradigm. And you can actually get these patients over a period of time to get off these medications. And in Sound Sleep, I have an entire section devoted to this concept of what it takes to kind of prepare yourself to get off the medication. And it's not like it's an impossible thing to do. It's just that it takes time, because you really do have to, number one, treat your breathing disorder if you have it. And number two, you do have to learn to be better at improving your coping skills and being able to work directly with your emotions in a more honest and efficient way.
Plus, I'll bet people develop a kind of psychological dependence, if not a physiological one, of feeling like, boy, I need this crutch. If I don't take my pill, I'm not going to be able to sleep.
Well, not only that, but let's come full circle. Once you have gotten dependent on these medications, you will lose your wave of sleepiness.
Yes,
it was no longer something that you can attend to, because you're relying on the pill to create the wave of sleepiness, which it does, and it does effectively, as again, for certain people at certain times, it's a miraculous drug. But most people really can learn to recruit the wave of sleepiness on their own, and when you teach them that, they will usually realize they certainly don't need these medications every night, and if they need them occasionally, that's fine. That's the way that they were intended to be prescribed.
What about age? You know, being on that end of the spectrum here, we sort of regularly hear that, oh, well, you're an older person. Older people can't sleep through the night. They wake up during the night, blah, blah, blah. And supposedly natural melatonin production drops off with age. So personally, I've been taking melatonin as a supplement, and it seems to be helpful. What's your take on as we get older, are sleep problems inevitable?
I don't think they're inevitable, but I will say this, that certain aging things, changes, whether it's pro-inflammatory states or oxidative stress, I mean, whatever the thing that's going on with aging does seem to have an impact on the way you breathe. And so when you hear about people saying, I was sleeping just fine until I was 40 or 50 or 60, one of the first things to think about is not aging. It's to think about, did aging do something that would cause you to have a sleep problem? And so two things come up physiologically that are very common. People who report the onset of sleep problems after the age of 50 or 60 almost always could have either a breathing problem or a leg jerk or leg movement problem, because there are tremendous correlations there, and nobody knows for sure why this is, but there really is difficulty with the breathing maintaining itself correctly or with the person not developing this leg jerk problem. Both of those will eventually cause, you know, terrible sleep quality problems, and in a fair number of cases, it will also cause insomnia.
Well, there's so much more that we could keep talking about, but we should probably wrap it up here.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've given enough to put people to sleep, huh?
No, you've woken me up to some fresh ideas here, and I'm putting them into practice.
I want to get you out here to get a sleep study and have you see the whole process and see whether or not you think the psychological and the physiological is relevant to some of your own, you know, rare bouts of insomnia.
Yeah, well, I would love to do that. Dr. Barry Krakow, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Barry Krakow and got some useful tips if you suffer at all from insomnia. If you do, I definitely recommend his 2007 book, Sound Sleep, Sound Mind. Also, as you heard here, you can find information about his upcoming workshops on his websites, which include sleeptreatment.com and nightmaretreatment.com. I also interviewed Barry on his approach to treating PTSD on my other podcast series, Wise Counsel, at wisecounselpodcast.com. That interview will probably go up a month or two after this one, however. You might recall Barry mentioning that he draws upon the work of Dr. Leslie Greenberg and his emotion-focused therapy. Well, it so happens I interviewed Dr. Greenberg for Wise Counsel on June 1st, 2010. So you might want to check that out as well if you missed it.
Been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Welcome back, all you regulars, and a big welcome to any first-timers. I'm so glad to have all of you here. It looks like in addition to my two podcast series, Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel, I'm going to be blogging for Psychology Today. Psychology Today is a magazine, and they also have a major web portal with a stable of bloggers. I received an invitation this past week from Catherine Schreiber, who it turns out is a listener and also an intern at Psychology Today while finishing up her degree in psychology at Sarah Lawrence. Right now we're going back and forth on an appropriate name and focus for the blog. Whatever the name, my primary motivation is to use it as yet another way of getting some exposure for these podcasts. So thank you, Catherine. And I'll keep you all posted as to the final name and location of the new blog series. Now, speaking of the Wise Counsel series, you might want to check out my latest Wise Counsel interview with Sharon Rivkin, MA, MFT, on resolving arguments. Sharon is a friend of some of my other Sonoma County friends, and she's got a book out that's been doing quite well, intended primarily for couples. It's titled Breaking the Argument Cycle, How to Stop Fighting Without Therapy. I mentioned on the last episode that I have an opportunity to get my own Shrink Wrap Radio iPhone app, but I haven't heard back from any of you about whether you'd be interested in such a thing. It would allow any of you who are iPhone or iPad owners to stream the show to your device without having to take up valuable memory space. It would sell for $2.99 US. I just don't know if I have enough listeners out there for it to be worth the effort. So drop me a line if this is a development you'd like to see come to fruition. We have yet a new ad on our top 10 widget in the right-hand sidebar of the Shrink Wrap Radio homepage. Last week, I announced a link to the blog and podcast about Viktor Frankl's logotherapy. Well, this week, we have added a new link to an addiction recovery treatment center located in a picturesque country setting. Check it out. Remember, anyone can purchase one of these little ads for a one-time fee of $20 right on the site, and it will stay up there until 10 or more such ads come along and bump it off, which in all likelihood would be quite a while. So this is one of the best advertising bargains around, as I have said before. Now, don't forget, we also have a store tab on our site where you can purchase archival CDs covering the first episodes of the show at $9.95 each, plus shipping. We also, if you need any CE units, we have APA-accredited courses where you can earn your units by listening to selected podcasts. We've got one course on the wisdom of the dream and another on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. And while you're on our site, you'll also find links to discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and ShoeBuy.com. I myself have saved money on printer ink at 4inkjets.com. And the dress shoes that I ordered from ShoeBuy.com arrived, but they're a bit large. The great thing is I can send them back for a smaller size for free, no shipping charges. Do be sure to help evangelize about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, colleagues, fellow students, relatives, strangers in the street. I know that there's a much larger potential listenership than I've been able to get in so far. Also, don't forget to blog and Twitter about your favorite episodes. And there are actually flyers on the site under the promo tab that you can post in public places. Now, thanks to all of you for clicking on that big green donate button on our homepage. Your one-time and ongoing donations help to keep the flame burning. In fact, I'd like to acknowledge our September 2010 donors, and I hope none will be offended by this show of public gratitude. We received a total of $375 this past month as a result of ongoing and one-time contributions from Joseph Pentany, Justin Pritchard, Trevor Ehrman, John Bruce, Peter R. Myron, Alan Tabor, Leon Sang, Neam Joyce, Catherine Lee, Kathleen Vortman, Gary Graham, Alexandra Levy, and Eric Begay. So a big thank you to all you donors, And to the rest of you, please consider adding your name to this honor roll of Shrink Wrap Radio supporters.
Hi, this is Rick Hansen, neuropsychologist and author of the book Buddha's Brain, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Rick Hansen, who will be my guest on our next episode. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. You may recall my reading an email last time from Peter B. Todd, my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 240, about an upcoming conference in Sydney, Australia, featuring as keynote speaker Dr. Jonathan Shedler, my guest on episode number 236 on the efficacy of psychodynamic psychotherapies. I recently suggested to Peter that he try contacting Natasha Mitchell, the host of the Australian Broadcasting Company's radio program and podcast, All in the Mind, which is one of my favorites, and that she might be interested in covering the conference. Well, Peter just sent me an email saying, "Dear David, more good news. I was speaking to conference convener Dr. Timothy Keogh today about the November conference. I found out that Jonathan Shedler is indeed being interviewed on the All in the Mind program on ABC National Radio about his keynote lecture and controversial publication. It also appears that some of the more zealous cognitive behavioral therapist dogmatists are somewhat perturbed that such an international celebrity would dare to promote the evidence-based for psychodynamic psychotherapy. In open Protestant revolt against the dominant paradigm. Keep up your evangelizing on Shrink Wrap Radio. Kindest regards, Peter B. Todd." So to keep up my evangelizing, I encourage all you Australian listeners to attend this important conference, which is open to all. The conference will be on Saturday, November 13, 2010, in Sydney, Australia. And I've put the PDF of the conference flyer with full registration details on our site. You'll find it under the promos tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. Do take a look. Next, we hear from Trish, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I recently found a fascination with the human mind and behavior which surfaced recently after I've been led to yoga and other Eastern meditative practices and or philosophy. I've been entertaining the idea of getting my master's in counseling psychology, and I think it will be an enriching experience exposing myself to a wide variety of psychology topics. I stumbled upon your podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I'm here to offer my help to transcribe podcasts. Yay! Please let me know which one you'd like me to get started on, what your expectations are, and I would zealously get to work. Thank you for all you do. Best regards, Trish Sebastian." Trish, thank you so much for your kind offer. I responded to Trish, gave her an assignment, and I will announce it as soon as she sends that transcript to me. And here's one more, this one from Andre in Norway. "Hello, Dr. Dave. I love your show. I started to listen to the show at number one, and now 3 weeks later, I'm on show number 36. Wow. It just gets better and better. I am a man who loves psychology. I've played with the thought of studying psychology for 2 years, and now I've made up my mind that I'm going to do it. Yesterday, I ordered some books that were recommended on this show, and I'm very excited to get them. The books are Altered States of Consciousness, Lucid Dreaming, A Concise Guide to Awakening in Your Dreams and in Your Life, Psychological Types, and The Hero with a Thousand Faces. I'm especially looking forward to reading The Hero with a Thousand Faces. I have a recommendation for a guest on the show. It's Richard D. Blackstone. He sends out emails, love mails as he calls them. He's very interesting. His philosophy of life is that we are all one and we're all made of love. Check out his website, and he gives me a link to richardblackstone.com. and wecreateonelove.com. He said, "I'd also like to recommend some Buddhist monks," and he recommends Pra Noa Yutadamo. He's an American monk, and he gives me a link on YouTube. And he says, "And if possible, I would really like to have Thich Nhat Hanh on the show." Well, that would be quite a catch if I were able to get Thich Nhat Hanh. If you have an email address for him, let me know, anybody out there. He says, I feel that I have questions, but I do not know what to ask. Oh, well, I love your show. It's the best ever. A warm greeting from Norway. And that's from Andy. And Andy, thank you for becoming a Shrink Wrap Radio listener. And I am excited to hear about your great excitement. So that better wrap it up for today. Remember, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. We had some interesting ones in response to the last show. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail here in the U.S. at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Barry Krakow for his tips on developing sound sleep, sound mind. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will feature Dr. Rick Hansen, the lead author of the book Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. I was very excited to have the opportunity to interview Rick about this wonderful book, and I think we had great rapport. You can check that out for yourself when you listen back in. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.